And ready to roll?
Yep.
Okay. Again, this is a merciless pace I'm setting this evening because I got a lot to talk about and a limited amount of time to do it. If you are not able to, if you missed part of the lecture, if you got to leave early, the tapes are available from She Who Remembers, and don't forget it. Now, Charles Willoughby was MacArthur's chief of staff and a doctrinaire fascist from 1939 right on up through 1950. The man had more connections than a switchboard, and we're going to detail some of those in a minute. It's worth noting that internationally he was connected with the forces of international fascism. He was very deeply involved with Asian fascists, including elements that ultimately coalesced in the Asian People's Anti-Communist League, the Asian version of the World Anti-Communist League, or WACL. He was very close to Francisco Franco and Nazi elements in exile in Spain, which it effectively governed Germany from Spain. It was an effective Nazi government in exile. He was very close to General Reinhard Gehlen, and in fact was at one point offering to liaise between Gehlen and Alan Dulles. Very close to the anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations. That was a consortium of Central and Eastern European fascists, which became a key element of WACL. ABN was basically a renaming and reconstitution of the Committee of Subjugated Nations, a consortium of Eastern European fascists put together by Adolf Hitler in 43. In addition to Germany, Japan, and Italy, the Axis consisted of the Bulgarian National Front, the Hungarian Arrow Cross, the Romanian Iron Guard, for a time Finland, the Baltic states, a quote independent, unquote, Croatia, quote independent, unquote, Slovakia, note the quotes. Those Eastern European fascists, ally, political and military allies of Hitler, were coalesced in the Committee of Subjugated Nations in 43. That simply evolved into the anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations, centrally involved in the Kennedy assassination, a major player in sub rosa international politics. Willoughby was very close to that as well. Now, we should note in detailing the evolution of Charles Willoughby that I believe that Willoughby, whose real loyalties were to fascism and to fascist Spain and Germany, fascist elements within Germany, I believe that Willoughby, in fact, played a deliberately subversive role in the Korean War. Bear in mind that this is an opinion. I cannot prove this. But Willoughby was MacArthur's G2 from 39 through 1950. It was presumably Willoughby who, despite the fact that MacArthur had 8 hours warning about the attack on Pearl Harbor, took no effective steps to protect the Philippines. MacArthur's air component and much of the rest of his forces were caught flat-footed when the Japanese struck in the Philippines 8 hours after leveling Pearl Harbor and sinking most of our battleships. Interestingly enough, Willoughby seemed remarkably incapable, and he was a brilliant and very powerful individual, some 6'2 or 6'3, steely blue eyes, and a very formidable individual, also a very skilled intelligence officer, put together something called Field Operations Intelligence, one of the most effective and hush-hush American military intelligence units in the post-war period. And yet he seemed remarkably incompetent with regard to the Korean War, although there were clear indications that the Koreans were massing on the South Korean border. Willoughby gave no warning of that. There were overwhelming indications that the Chinese were massing at the Korean border. They then cut off MacArthur's troops, forcing the fighting retreat, of which the retreat from Chosin Reservoir is probably the best known episode. The Korean War was a major boon for fascism around the world. In particular, the total relaxation of denazification in Germany was affected during the Korean War. Even one of the Krupps noted that the Americans' attitude towards us changed considerably once the Korean War began. I suspect, but cannot prove, that Willoughby deliberately allowed the U.S. troops, and bear in mind that he was a German-born fascist allied with Franco, I suspect that Willoughby deliberately allowed the North Koreans and later the Chinese communists to gain an element of surprise, of course at the expense of many American lives, in order to further the cause of militant extremist anti-communism. Now, the Korean War and the events stemming from that, in many ways, is the pivotal element in the evolution of the paramilitary right. And some of the hocus-pocus you're hearing today about the United Nations and one world government evolves from this period. Now, the League of Nations was demonized by the far right, so in a sense, the anti-UN rhetoric that we are seeing now and that is characteristic of the Patriots and Militia movement began in the pre-World War II period with the bashing of the League of Nations. But much of the hysterical anti-UN sentiment goes back to the days of the Korean War. Of course, the U.S. forces there were operating under U.N. Sponsorship, and it was when Douglas MacArthur was relieved of his command by Harry Truman that the events precipitating the rise of the paramilitary right, I think the ultimate revolt by our military against its commander-in-chief, which we saw on November 22nd, 1963, I think those forces began at that time. We should note, too, that MacArthur has long been the darling of American fascists, Gerald L. K. Smith, and William Dudley Pelley, and as well as most American reactionaries, supported MacArthur for president. For some reason, his candidacy never really took off. But MacArthur was a god to the American far right. And bear in mind that his former father-in-law, Edward Stotesbury, was a Key Morgan partner and a financier of American fascist groups. Bear in mind the 34 coup attempt. They wanted MacArthur, but they knew he was too unpopular as a result of crushing the Bonus Marchers. Now, when General MacArthur was replaced by Truman, there stemmed from that a virtual revolt, initially not an overt revolt, but later on November 22nd, 1963, a literal revolt by the U.S. military, who were outraged that a civilian commander-in-chief, by the way, a very much decorated soldier in World War I, that a civilian commander-in-chief would have the temerity to replace an individual who at the time was arguably America's most popular and glorified military officer, namely Douglas MacArthur. Willoughby resigned his command at that time, and many of MacArthur's staffers left the military at that time and gravitated into the ranks of the American far, far right. Again, the replacement of MacArthur was one of the things that not only led to the demonization of civilian leadership by key American staff officers, it was the root element in the anti-UN sentiment. Again, one of the things that's very disturbing about the Militia and Patriot Network is all of this talk about how the United Nations is going to take over the United States using Russian troops ferried in black helicopters. The United Nations is one of the most benign institutions on the face of the earth and also badly underfunded. The United Nations can't handle Somalia, and the Russians can't handle Chechnya. They're sure as bloody hell not going to handle the United States, and that makes the rather airy assumption that either wants to, and I've seen no indication that either does. It's preposterous. It is utterly preposterous. Yet, the root of that very significant political mythology goes back to the Korean War, in which the replacement of Douglas MacArthur by Harry Truman led to a verbal and ideological revolt by American staff officers against their civilian commander-in-chief. It also, by the way, disenchanted many of them from the standpoint of combat. One of the things that led many officers to begin to question the wisdom of having a civilian commander-in-chief was that while the negotiations were going on, and they lasted about 2 years, the situation vis-a-vis combat in Korea persisted, and troops were ordered to take a particular hill, and they had their buddies killed. They would then be ordered to retreat from that hill and then retake it at the loss of a tremendous number of lives. This embittered many of the combat soldiers in Korea, and I can fully understand their perspective, and it led them to suspect that, in fact, they were being cynically and brutally maneuvered by an international government that really was sympathetic to the communists and that did not have the best interests of the United States at heart. They attributed this to the United Nations, hence this, you know, one-world government involving, you know, loose associations, but or the myth of the one-world government involving, you know, Jewish bankers, the United Nations, and taking over the United States. It had its roots in what is an understandable situation. Here were these combat soldiers going through the pure hell of total combat, taking a hill, watching their buddies killed, risking their necks, then being ordered to retreat, then retaking the hill, seeing more of their buddies killed for nothing. Although it was not the United Nations that were responsible for this, and it was not the commander-in-chief who was responsible for this, it was actually battlefield and divisional commanders giving those orders. The blame fell on Truman, the blame fell on the UN, and the roots of the evolution of the paramilitary right and the eventual overthrow of legitimate constitutional authority were basically planted in the soil at this time. That's where you hear all this crap about the UN and the conspiracy theories that we're hearing right now. Korea, the UN, and the replacement of MacArthur by General Truman. Now, in understanding the paramilitary right and the extreme right in general, in understanding domestic American fascism, it's important to understand that many of these groups overlap each other, and that in turn, as we're going to see in a minute, the paramilitary right in turn overlaps the national security establishment. I want to stress very emphatically that they are not coterminous. American fascist groups and the military are not coterminous. American fascist groups and the paramilitary right are not coterminous. By the same token, there is a significant area of overlap between the government, quote unquote, and the paramilitary right, and we're going to study that overlap. We're going to study it from an operational sense, and I think this will give us some perspective during the second half of the lecture on the militia movement, which elements of which I believe are a pawn of the very government they present themselves as being opposed to. Bear in mind, again, the ideological mystification that the social revolutionary wing of the Nazi Party was subject to in the Weimar period in Germany. Here were a bunch of people who were disaffected leftists and communists and socialists seeking to overthrow the Weimar Republic in order to install Adolf Hitler in order to counteract the forces of international capitalism and finance. Well, in fact, they were installing an individual and a government that was the very embodiment of overbearing international corporatism and finance, but they were not told this. By the same token, I think the sincerely democratic and sincerely patriotic elements within the militias are in fact being similarly deceived and similarly and cynically manipulated in order to install fascism in the United States, and I think that they will share the fate of the Gregor Strasser wing of the Nazi Party, the National Bolsheviks, and the Social Revolutionary wing of the early Nazi Party. Once the deed is done, they will be liquidated. That is my considered opinion. Now, the far right and the paramilitary right once again overlap the MacArthur group, and that's very important to understand. We're going to look at members of the MacArthur group, bearing in mind its history and its genesis that I've already laid out for you. Willoughby, to give you an idea of how powerful he was. Now, he's connected with Galen, the Nazi Eastern Front spy chief we took in at the end of World War II. The Third Reich's Eastern Front Intelligence Service, Fremde Heere Ost, was incorporated into our intelligence system at the end of World War II, became the CIA's Department of Russian and Eastern European Affairs, became the de facto NATO intelligence organization, and eventually involved into the BND, the Bundesnachrichtendienst, the German intelligence service, for my money, probably the finest intelligence service in the world in terms of skill. And interesting enough, the BND continued to provide the United States and NATO with most of their intelligence even after it became the BND. And it was a direct projection forward in time and across the Atlantic of the very core of the Third Reich's national security establishment. Much of the Odessa network was incorporated into the Galen network. It paved the way for thousands of SS and Gestapo veterans to move up into NATO and U.S. intelligence. And we should also note that the German German General Staff's chain of command was still in effect. Even after he went to work for the Americans, Galen was still reporting to Admiral von Dönitz, who succeeded Hitler, and also to General Franz Halder, his chief of staff, indicating that even when working for the Americans, Galen was the Third Reich's chain of command was still in operation. It's one of the things that permitted the Third Reich to not only go underground, but to successfully prevail in the post-World War II period, and I believe that has happened. I've talked about that that victory of the underground Reich, which will manifest itself completely in the 21st century, in my opinion, in other lectures. Again, I can appreciate that people who are new to my lectures, they say, what the heck? You know, who baked this fruitcake, man? The Third Reich went underground and survived? Ye gods, man, I paid $10 for this. I'd rather have the original fruitcake. But believe me, it's true. And by way of understanding Willoughby, powerful figure, powerful in the United States, powerful in the military, powerful in the civilian right, powerful abroad, connected to Franco, connected to the ABN, connected to Galen, connected to Nazi elements around the world, including the powerful Odessa network, the post-World War II SS underground. And this is a man with more connections than a switchboard. He enjoyed tremendous loyalties among the residual MacArthur staffers, and he was either directly involved with or a senior advisor to most of the major right-wing groups in the United States. He was involved with the Young Americans for Freedom, a most inappropriately named group, elements of which appear to have been involved in the operational level with the Kennedy assassination. He was involved with the John Birch Society. He was involved with the American Security Council, a private American intelligence organization composed of ex-FBI agents who felt that Joe McCarthy was a good guy and didn't want to see his work and the work of the House Un-American Activities Committee neutralized. So they got together and they utilized as their intelligence base the files of Harry Young's American Vigilance Intelligence Federation. Harry Young was a Chicago-based American fascist and anti-Semite who worked with the Hitler-Goebbels anti-Comintern in the 1930s and 40s. The anti-Comintern was an international fascist consortium using anti-communism as its international ideological cement. The ASC, by the way, deeply involved with the political evolution of not only Richard Nixon, but also Ronald Reagan, also very closely connected with the World Anti-Communist League, which was basically a recapitulation of the Hitler-Goebbels anti-Comintern in the post-World War II period. Will it be centrally involved with an American far right-wing activist group heavily overlapping American intelligence and military called the Anti-Communist Liaison, which had a meeting in the spring of 1963 and may have been involved in the planning of President Kennedy's assassination. He also had his own international private intelligence network called the International Committee for the Defense of Christian Culture, which incorporated such people as Nelson Bunker Hunt, a member of the Hunt family and a key financier of WACL, far-right and fascist causes in the United States. It also involved in the German end, for example, people like Hermann Punder, a key Abwehr agent and later a key official in the early years of the World Anti-Communist League. Theodor Oberlander, an SS officer and German cabinet minister, who had headed up the Einsatzgruppe Nachtigall, or the Einsatzgruppe Nightingale. The Einsatzgruppen were the mobile killing squads which followed the German frontline troops into the Soviet Union and conducted the on-site liquidations of Jews, communists, and other people deemed enemies by the Third Reich. The Einsatzgruppe Nachtigall employed the Ukrainian fascists and nationalists from the OUN Bandera, the Organization of Ukrainian Nationalists, under Stepan Bandera, who also became a key Galen functionary, key WACL functionary, and whose assassination in 1959, on the same day Lee Harvey Oswald defected to the Soviet Union, as I've indicated in past lectures, was used by the WACL milieu to deflect attention away from the reality of Kennedy's assassination to try to pin it on the KGB. Another group that Willoughby was very close to were the Shikshini Knights of Malta. Now, the Knights of Malta were an elite military wing of the Catholic Church. They date back to the Crusades. They were scattered by Napoleon when he occupied Malta. Later, they were revived by the Church. One of the czars incorporated elements of the Knights into his situation in Imperial Russia. They then fled to various centers around the globe, including Shikshini, Pennsylvania, where they remained based. Once the Bolshevik Revolution took place, they were a mixture of ardent, extreme right-wing anti-communists and outright raving fascists. Willoughby was hired as their security general in 1963. The head of the Shikshini Knights was a fellow named Colonel Charles Pichel, P-I-C-H-E-L, who, when Hitler came to power in the early 30s, requested of the Führer that he be appointed the official liaison by the Third Reich to the United States. Other key members of the Shikshini Knights involved Pedro del Valle, again, a MacArthur general staff officer and general. People like Lemuel Shepard, again, a MacArthur protege and general of the Marine Corps. People like Sir Admiral Sir Barry Domville from Great Britain, who had been interned during World War II for being a Nazi agent and sympathizer of the Third Reich. Also people like Colonel, what's his first name? Philip Corso. I keep thinking Max Corso, but he was a Corsican gangster who was part of the SAC milieu. Colonel Philip Corso was an American intelligence officer who favored the resurrection of many of the Eastern European fascist collaborationist networks subsumed under the Galen-Wackel ABN umbrella in order to combat communism in the 1960s. Needless to say, the Shikshini Knights of Malta were not exactly a group of Eagle Scouts. It was basically a fascist group, again, heavily overlapping the MacArthur group. Also, Willoughby was very close to the WACCFL, the World Anti-Communist Congress for Freedom and Liberation, a most inappropriately named group. That was the steering group, the C group, for what became the World Anti-Communist League, an international anti-communist consortium incorporating overtly fascist elements. Many of them evolved from the Third Reich. It became best known as one of the vehicles for the Contra support operation in the 1980s. Also, another group, I do not know if Willoughby was involved with this, I suspect he may have been, but I do not know that he was. But another very important group to understand is another most inappropriately named group called the Congress of Freedom. The Congress of Freedom was formed in 1953 by disaffected right-wingers, including people involved with the U.S. military. They basically were an extreme right-wing group, many of them very wealthy independently. The Congress of Freedom had a Congress in the spring of 1963, specifically April of 1963, at which they talked about the necessity for assassinating key American political leaders in order to further the cause of international anti-communism. The Congress of Freedom had in its membership many high-ranking, active duty American military officers. And we're going to talk about evidentiary tributaries running between the Congress of Freedom and the assassination of President Kennedy a little later. Again, in discussing the evolution of the paramilitary right, it's important to understand that it overlaps, although is not coterminous with, American fascist groups whose genesis began in the pre-World War II and World War II period. It overlaps but is not coterminous with the military, including many retired military who network actively with many of their active duty compatriots and former associates. It is important to understand, too, that the paramilitary right functions on behalf of and works with, though again is not coterminous with, the U.S. national security establishment, with, quote, the government, unquote, that the militias, we're being told, are enemies of. And as we're going to see, I think the fascist elements within the militias are actually an extension of some elements of the government, in many cases unwitting pawns. In some cases, I suspect they are knowledgeable pawns. By the way, we should note that among the people in attendance at the Congress of Freedom in April of 1963 was an American fascist named Joseph Adams Miltier, last name M-I-L-T-E-E-R. We're going to remember that name, Joseph Adams Miltier. We're going to come back to him in just a few minutes in connection with the assassination of not only President Kennedy, but also Martin Luther King. And one of the things he boasted about after the Kennedy assassination was that the Patriots Network, again, note that use of the term, the Patriots Network had infiltrated the left and the pro-Castro activists in the country and had successfully manipulated Oswald and in order to pin the blame for Kennedy's assassination on the communists. He also talked about being in touch with, quote, an international underground, quote, unquote. I suspect that was what I have referred to as the Underground Reich, the Odessa Network, and related elements that I've already touched on. Joseph Adams Miltier, I think, when talking about the Patriots movement had successfully infiltrated the pro-Castro elements, exemplifies the abuse of the term patriots, which we are seeing in connection with some elements of the militia movement. Again, many of them are sincere conservatives and sincere patriots, although badly misinformed for the most part, and I think cynically used, but many of them are outright raving Nazis and fascists, and important to understand that. Again, James Wickstrom, he's a patriot. He began with the silver shirts that tried to overthrow the U.S. government on behalf of Nazi Germany. That's patriotism. I'd hate to see treason. Bear in mind, too, the old adage that patriotism is the last refuge of a scoundrel. Religion, by the way, is usually the first, so bear that in mind. Now, in understanding the evolution of the paramilitary right, and I think a group which in its paradigms and in its operations and its connections could be viewed as the direct precursor of the militias of today, and that is a group called the Minutemen. Of course, they were named after the irregular colonial infantry during our War of Independence, who very successfully fought against the British. The idea behind the Minutemen, who formed, by the way, in 1960, at the height of the U-2 crisis, a group of hunters in Missouri were discussing the possibility that the United States might be invaded by Russia. To give you an idea of how badly misinformed we are as a public, there was never any possibility of the Soviet Union invading Western Europe, let alone the United States. They didn't have the capabilities for doing that. They never were designing their weapons and logistical systems to do that. They couldn't have done it anyway. It would have resulted in a nuclear holocaust, let alone invading the United States. Any more than the United Nations is going to invade the United States using UN or using Russian troops under... It's sadly and tragically stupid. It was never a possibility, and yet the fact that that was believed is important to understand, and understanding the not only the ideological mystification, but the sheer mythology that drives American reaction. I'm reminded of the movie Cabaret, by the way, where one woman is saying, talking about ideological mystification of fascism, A woman is reading the Völkische Beobachter, the official party of the German Nazi Party, and she says, by the way, is there anybody here who doesn't know what I'm talking about when I talk about the movie Cabaret? It's a musical about the rise of fascism in Germany. It's a damn, I generally don't have any use for musicals, but that's a damn good film. So I think it might be one of the best edited movies of all time. It deserved the Academy Awards it got, even though I can't stand musicals, which I think is a really corny genre. You know, I mean, some guy walk in and say, hi, Bill, hi, Fred. What's new? Well, I've just met the most wonderful girl. I've just met a girl. Yeah, crock, you know, absolute crock, you know, but Cabaret is quite good. But at one point in that movie, based, by the way, on the I Am a Camera by Christopher Isherwood and Goodbye to Berlin, Isherwood was a British exchange student in Berlin who actually saw the rise of fascism. By the way, he was living in Los Angeles in 1980 as Reagan was coming to power and commented, he said, the same thing I saw in Berlin in the 30s is happening here in the United States. The only difference is the Germans put up a lot more resistance than the Americans are doing, which is something to think about. But at one point in the movie Cabaret, a woman is saying, but I don't understand. How can the Jews be both bankers and communists at the same time? Obvious question. And so the husband says, simple. If they don't get us one way, they'll get us the other. You know, and that is something to think about. The notion that the Jews dominate international finance is a bunch of poppycock. Again, seven of the 10 largest commercial banks in the world are Japanese. Not a lot of Jews in Japan. And the other three are the Chase Manhattan, the Deutsche and Dresdner banks. But, you know, reality doesn't trouble a lot of people. And again, this is not to attack or put down the people who sincerely believe in those things. But the disinformation and the ideological mystification is worth taking into account. Now, the Minutemen, again, formed in 1960 at the height of the U2 crisis when a number of hunters in the Midwest decided that they should get together and organize in the event of a Soviet invasion of the United States, where they would once again fight in the streets for their freedom, as Americans had done in the Revolutionary War. One of their members was a former Green Beret who hauled out all of his training manuals and began employing those in connection with the Minutemen. Now, once again, I want to stress that although the paramilitary right and fascist elements within the political structure and the national security establishment are not coterminous by any means, that's a very important point to understand. At the same time, they overlap in significant respects, and that area of overlap is something to bear in mind, and that's what we're going to be focusing on in connection with the Minutemen, and then later in the second part of the lecture, after a very short break, we're going to take a look at that in connection with the militias as well. The Minutemen were headed up by a guy named Robert Bolivar Depew, some of the last name capital D-E, capital P-U-G-H. Some of the key members of the Minutemen, he had an aide named Walter Payson, a former Marine. He had a fellow named Troy Houghton, last name H-O-U-G-H-T-O-N, and also a very important name, and one that we're going to come back to in a second in connection with use of Minutemen elements as part of the CIA's anti-Castro and military intelligence anti-Castro effort, and also in connection with the assassination of President Kennedy, and in all probability some of our other assassinations as well. That's a fellow named Richard Lockley, and I'm not sure how it's pronounced, because I've never heard it spoken, L-A-U-C-H-L-I. Okay, once again, Richard Lockley, L-A-U-C-H-L-I. Now, as was the case with Willoughby, the Minutemen, and I'm going to suggest that there is a parallel between the way the Minutemen overlap, but once again are not coterminous with many fascist groups, and the way the militias also overlap, but are not coterminous with fascist groups. And in turn, I'm going to suggest that those elements of the militias that so overlap those groups, just like those elements of the Minutemen that overlap these groups, were used as pawns by elements of the government. The Minutemen, who operated nationwide, were overlapped very heavily, but by no means coterminous with most of the domestic fascist and extreme right-wing groups. They were overlapped with the National States Rights Party, headed up by J.B. Stoner, elements of which crop up in context with the assassination of Martin Luther King. They heavily overlapped the Ku Klux Klan. They heavily overlapped the American Nazi Party. By the way, its Fuhrer, George Lincoln Rockwell, was assassinated as Jim Garrison's investigation began gaining force. Rockwell's Arlington, Virginia name, address, and phone number were in Lee Harvey Oswald's address book at the time of his arrest. And nobody asked any questions what the alleged Marxist Oswald was doing with people like that in his address book. Also, another American Nazi named Daniel Burroughs. By the way, the American Nazi Party member who killed Rockwell was a Minuteman infiltrator in the ANP. Depew hated Rockwell and took a lot of pride in the fact that one of his infiltrators was the assassin of Rockwell. I personally suspect that was done on behalf of the National Security Establishment, because Rockwell might have had a lot of embarrassing things to say about the alleged Marxist and lone nut, Lee Harvey Oswald. Also, Daniel Burroughs, another American Nazi Party member and an editor of Stormtrooper, the American Nazi Party paper, a guy named Daniel Burroughs committed suicide, quote unquote, in 1965. Daniel Burroughs' name also and his address were in Oswald's address book. Burroughs committed suicide on the Reading, Pennsylvania estate or home, at the home of a Pennsylvania Klansman named Roy Frankhauser, who also was involved with the Minutemen, who later became a contract agent for the CIA. And as Frankhauser has noted, that the alleged suicide of Burroughs was, quote, bad case of suicide, three bullets, you know, the old three-bullet suicide. However, in the world of miracles, you know, a three-bullet suicide can take place. We should also note, and this is even more important, that the Minutemen overlapped a very important group that we're going to come to deal with, and one of the evolutionary predecessors of the fascist elements within the militias, such as some of the Aryan Nation elements. That is called the Christian Defense League. The Christian Defense League was headed up by Wesley Swift, again, who was a protege of Gerald L. K. Smith, the American fascist and Ford-funded individual I spoke about earlier when I talked about Ford begetting Hitler, then begetting Smith, who begat Gale, and Butler, and then, you know, tongue-in-cheek, obviously. The Christian Defense League also overlapped the Minutemen and overlapped the Aryan Nations, so what became the Aryan Nations. One of the principal people involved with the Christian Defense League was William Potter Gale, again, the MacArthur staffer and much decorated guerrilla leader in the Philippines about whom we spoke earlier. Now, William Potter Gale is one of the individuals who represents an element of continuity from the MacArthur group to the post-World War II American paramilitary right and fascist elements. In addition, the Minutemen also overlapped the Patriotic Party, also something called the American Volunteer Group, about which we're going to have more to say in just a minute. Now, as I've indicated, one of the important things to understand about the paramilitary right is that it actually has been used by the National Security Establishment. It has functioned as a de facto extension of the National Security Establishment in a fashion not unlike the way the Freikorps or so-called Black Reichswehr functioned in Weimar Germany. First of all, Richard Lockley, the Minuteman that I spoke about earlier, was involved with the anti-Castro Cuban effort, and in fact he was rounded up along with a number of other people when there was an FBI raid on a guerrilla training camp at Lake Pontchartrain outside of New Orleans. Later on, the indictments against the people in this raid were dismissed. We should note that this particular milieu also overlapped some other Minutemen that we're going to talk about. Guy Bannister, one of the principal figures in the Kennedy assassination, one of the people who Jim Garrison looked into, although he had already died. David Ferry, the person Garrison indicted, was a member of the Minutemen, as was another member of Bannister's investigative staff, a guy named Hugh Ward. The indications are that the Minutemen were involved, elements of the Minutemen were involved with elements like the Christian Defense League in the CIA and military's anti-Castro efforts in the 1960s, and that they also later participated in American political assassinations, the JFK assassination in particular. Now, again, this is referential. I've lectured about the Kennedy assassination in the past. The Guy Bannister Detective Agency appears to have functioned as an intelligence front, also overlapped the World Anti-Communist League. He, Guy Bannister, former FBI special agent, was the head of the Anti-Communist League of the Caribbean, part of what became WACL. One of his investigators, Maurice Brooks Gatlin, was a key early functionary in helping to organize the WACL. Guy Bannister's detective agency was the base for Lee Harvey Oswald's alleged pro-Castro efforts in New Orleans in the summer of 1963. One of the things that convinced many liberals to cover up the assassination of President Kennedy, even though they knew what had happened, was because Lee Harvey Oswald was supposedly a communist. He, in fact, was a U.S. intelligence operative, infiltrated into the Soviet Union and leftist groups in the United States, given a left cover. He then was offed. He was fingered for the assassination, then killed before he could defend himself. This made a lot of people think that the communists had killed Kennedy. Indeed, a U.S. intelligence front called INCA, the Information Council of the Americas, was involved in taping Lee Harvey Oswald after a staged altercation in New Orleans. Oswald was the only member of the New Orleans chapter of the Fair Play for Cuba Committee, a pro-Castro group that was the focus of a CIA activity in the early 1960s. That activity, of course, designed to neutralize FPCC. Oswald was the only member of the New Orleans chapter of the Fair Play for Cuba Committee. The address stamped on the literature that he was handing out when he was accosted by a Cuban exile connected to the CIA named Carlos Bringier. They had a scuffle. This resulted in a TV interview, which was broadcast all over the United States the evening of the assassination and used to convince people that Oswald was a communist. The address on his literature was 544 Camp Street, which was a side entrance to the 531 Lafayette Place address that Guy Bannister's ravingly anti-communist detective agency was headquartered at. It also, Guy Bannister's operation was very clearly involved with anti-Castro raids, in all probability conducted on behalf of the Office of Naval Intelligence. Bannister had served with ONI. There's a letter from Bannister to a Naval Intelligence Reserve officer named Guy Johnson saying that in the TACA affair, that was a Latin American airline, we apparently cut across a CIA operation. The raid on Lake Pontchartrain training camp, again, which rounded up Richard Lockley, a key Minuteman, and aide to Robert Depew, that training operation that David Ferry was apparently involved in, as well as elements of Bannister's group, that was a U.S. intelligence operation, hence the fact that the indictments against them were later dropped. Again, Guy Bannister, David Ferry, Hugh Ward, another individual named Jerry Brooks, as well as Lockley, all members of the Minutemen, and all involved with the CIA's and U.S. intelligence anti-Castro efforts. And again, Lee Harvey Oswald, this pro-Marxist communist handing out Fair Play for Cuba Committee literature, had the same operational base as Guy Bannister, who was working for U.S. intelligence against Castro. And indeed, Guy Bannister's office, prior to being rented by Guy Bannister, had been rented by Sergio Arcacha Smith, a key anti-Castro Cuban, and it was the New Orleans headquarters for the Cuban Revolutionary Council, which was the CIA's anti-Castro Cuban umbrella organization. So here we have Oswald, the supposed pro-Castro communist, operating under the same address as an ardently anti-communist intelligence front, working against Castro on behalf of U.S. intelligence. Not too bloody likely. But again, it's important to understand that elements of the Minutemen, which overlapped elements of American fascism, as I've indicated, were deeply involved with U.S. intelligence in the anti-Castro efforts. Another person who was seen by witnesses around the 544 Camp Street, 531 Lafayette Place address, one was just a side entrance to the same building, the same floor, and that was William Potter Gale, again, the former MacArthur staffer of the Christian Defense League, whom I've already spoken about, head of one of the largest of the early California paramilitary groups, the California Rangers. Now, let's shift out to California. At, interestingly enough, another Lafayette Place, only this Lafayette Place in Los Angeles, in 1963 there were a series of meetings at a Minuteman associate and Klansman named G. Clinton Wheat, W-H-E-A-T. The people who were involved at these meetings were an interesting group of people. One of them was a fellow named Lauren Eugene Hall. Actually, his middle name I may have wrong. Lauren Hall, anyway. His first and last names are right. In fact, yeah, I'm missing up the middle name. His name is Lauren Hall, H-A-L-L, who was a Minuteman associate who was involved with a number of U.S. intelligence fronts and was involved with the anti-Castro Cuban effort. Lauren Hall, interestingly enough, along with an associate named Lawrence Howard, showed up at the Dallas home of a Cuban exile named Silvio Odio in September of 1963. He was accompanied by a slight-looking Anglo man who was introduced as Leon Oswald. Okay, they spoke about how Kennedy had betrayed the Bay of Pigs, and then Leon Oswald volunteered that the Cuban exile should have assassinated Kennedy because he was the person who really held the key to the freedom of Cuba. When the FBI later interviewed Lauren Hall about this, he stated that no, in fact, the Leon Oswald was an associate named William Seymour, who looked like Oswald but was from Arizona. The FBI, neither the FBI nor the Warren Commission, asked the question of why William Seymour would have been using Leon Oswald's name in September of 1963, talking about plans to kill Kennedy. Okay? That's a fascinating question. By the way, in investigating the California connections to the Garrison investigation, then Reagan legal advisor Ed Meese, later became Attorney General, was using Lauren Hall rather as a source. Now, G. Clinton Wheat and his little clique of Minutemen and elements overlapping the Minutemen, California Defense League, various Nazi and fascist elements. G. Clinton Wheat was later subpoenaed by Jim Garrison as a material witness in his investigation. He then disappeared. As of 1971, I don't think anybody knew exactly what had happened to him. Another intimate of this very same circle at Lafayette Place in Los Angeles, again, a Minuteman milieu, was a guy named Edgar Eugene Bradley, the West Coast representative for the Reverend Carl McIntyre's American Council of Christian Churches, a group that fell to the right of Ivan the Terrible, deeply involved with American fascism. Edgar Eugene Bradley was indicted by Jim Garrison. The then Deputy State Attorney General Charles A. O'Brien reviewed the Garrison extradition request, recommended that it be granted. Ronald Reagan, then Governor of California, using Ed Meese as his legal advisor, who was conferring with Lauren Hall about the Edgar Eugene Bradley situation. Ronald Reagan delayed action until after Richard Nixon was elected president, then turned down Garrison's extradition request without comment. Bear in mind that Edgar Eugene Bradley was another of the people that was operating around the Lafayette Place address in Los Angeles, some members of whom appear to have also gone to the Lafayette Place 544 Camp Street address in New Orleans, again, also heavily overlapping the Minutemen, as well as U.S. intelligence in not only the CIA and military's anti-Castro Cuban efforts, but also, in all probability, the assassination of President Kennedy. In fact, certainly, the assassination of President Kennedy, as well as the subsequent American political assassinations. Now, we heard about the Congress of Freedom a little earlier, that most inappropriately named radical right-wing group involving high-ranking, active-duty American military officers that were talking in the spring of 1963 about the necessity for assassinating certain high-ranking American political figures in order to advance the cause of anti-communism. Okay, we're going to turn it over here. You know what? Actually, I think we're...